It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. For 150 years, the United States government operated hundreds of boarding schools. Native American children were separated from their homes and families with the goal of complete cultural assimilation. Many Native American children died of abuse and neglect and never returned home. The schools operated from 1819 to the 1960s, and last month, President Joe Biden became the first sitting president to apologize for what had been done.
I formally apologize as President of the United States of America for what we did. I formally apologize.
Overdue, Biden added, speaking a few weeks ago at the Gila River Indian Reservation outside Phoenix. Does the apology go far enough? And does this signal a shift in relations between the U.S. government and Native American people and communities? We're joined now by Professor Roslyn LaPierre, an indigenous writer, environmental historian, and ethnobotanist. She's also a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and a member of the Blackfeet of Montana and also Métis. Roslyn LaPierre, welcome back to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me today.
Listeners, you can join us today at 800-222-9455. What did you think of President Biden's recent apology? How would you like to see the U.S. government address this history of operating these Indian boarding schools? 800-222-9455. All right, I do want to talk about the boarding school apology in a moment, but first I want to begin just by sort of asking your reaction to the big news we've all been living with for the last week, and that's take your temperature on the election outcome. So how are you thinking about that?
Well, I think I'm thinking the same way a lot of Indigenous people are thinking, which is fear and uncertainty. I think that we saw the first administration, in 2016, 2017, and we saw that what changed and the policies that were put in place and how they impacted Indigenous communities. And so there's definitely a fear of what is going to happen the second time because, you know, for the most part, I think it's interesting when people say that, you know, like that former President Trump threatens some actions when actually he doesn't really threaten. He actually states what he's going to do and then he acts on it. So we have seen in the first administration, some of the things that were acted upon. So, for example, you know, the Bears Ears National Monument that was created was reduced by 85%. And it is a place that is sacred to many people in the Southwest. And it's an area that has still not really come back from losing that amount of land as a protected site. So there's a lot of different actions that he took as when he became president, and those are things that people are really concerned about.
Well, I'm glad you began with that, because I think you're sort of presaging an answer to another question I had, which is I looked at some of the exit polling. 1% of the respondents identified as Native American, which is really 230 people if you apply that to the total sample. I don't think that's enough for a statistically significant result. But the results were 2-1 for Trump. I wonder if you have better data or just a better sense of voting trends among Native American people.
Yeah, I would just say that those numbers have been refuted by nonprofit organizations in tribal communities and also by scholars. And in fact, just up the road here at Northwestern University, Stephanie Freiberg, who is a well-known sociologist, has written about how those numbers are really misleading and how because of that small number, right, they interviewed 229 people who self-identified as Native American. None of the people that were interviewed with that exit polling were near tribal lands. They weren't interviewing people who were on reservation communities or within communities that had large tribal populations. And she has offered that in a research that she has done that included 11,000 voters in the past couple of years, that more than 60% of those voters identified as liberal, 33% identified as moderate, and only 12% identified as conservative. So the numbers that we saw from the Edison research that have been quoted by a lot of different media, again, are just really misleading. One of the things that Stephanie Freiberg said, that not only are they misleading, but they're potentially harmful, and that it really doesn't accurately portray, you know, the Native American vote.
Yeah, well, I'm glad I put those caveats in, because, I mean, 1% is of a sample, even a sample that large, is just not statistically significant. I'm glad you raised some of the other issues that may be present in that data. All right, let's talk about President Biden and boarding schools. And I'll just begin by asking what you thought of his apology.
Well, on the one hand, I thought his apology was historic. You know, it's something, as has been mentioned in other outlets, you know, it's something that it's the first time that a sitting president has made this kind of apology in the United States. These kinds of apologies have been made in other places like Canada and Australia, but not here in the United States. One of the things that I think that he didn't go far enough was he didn't really name exactly what occurred in Indian boarding schools. And to me, the name that he needed to use was genocide. One of the things that historians have been working on, especially for the past few years, is trying to tell this, you know, true story of Indian boarding schools, but also just the history of the relationship between Indigenous peoples and the United States. And one of the things that we know was the true policy behind Indian boarding schools and its purpose was to erase Indigenous peoples from their own communities. And that erasure included removing children from their families and their communities, taking away their own names, erasing their languages, their religion, their cultural practices, changing their hairstyles even, and the clothing that they wore. So it really was a complete an effort to destroy Indigenous families and community. And that, by definition, is genocide.
Yeah, I recently saw a museum exhibit that covered some of this history, and there were even photos of families setting up encampments outside the grounds of these schools, but unable to get inside and make contact with their connection. This is not an abstract idea for you and your family, right? Can you talk about your personal history with this?
Yeah, so I'm part of the first generation of kids in my own family that went to day school. And by that, I mean schooled, you know, just down the street from where we lived. My mother went to boarding school. My grandparents, all four of my grandparents went to boarding school. Several of my great grandparents went to boarding school. And they both went to boarding schools that were either run by the United States government or run by the Catholic Church. So many churches worked in collaboration with the United States government, who paid the churches to have Indian boarding schools. So within my own family, there are a lot of people that were boarding school survivors, and they brought with them when they returned home a lot of the stories of what their experience was in those places that were really, as President Biden described, you know, horrible, and as Secretary Holland described, as places of terror and trauma.
So your mother is in her 80s, is the only remaining boarding school survivor in your family. This would have been then, what, the 40s, 50s? What were some of the stories that she's told you?
So my mother was born in 1940, and so she attended boarding school in the 1950s and the 1960s. She shared a lot of stories about, especially the punishment that children received for speaking their Indigenous languages. And in our case, the language was Blackfeet. One of the ways that they punished children was that they would not allow them to eat meals, and they would have them serve out punishment from doing things such as, you know, cleaning a bathroom with a toothbrush during a meal so that they would not be able to be fed. One of the things that happened in my mother's case was that oftentimes older children would steal food on her behalf and give it to her later because she was being punished for having spoken the Blackfeet language.
And you recently wrote an essay where you shared a story that she had seen another student had to have, or had lie put in her mouth?
Oh, that was a story that my grandmother told.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So my mother's mother, she went to a Catholic boarding school. And one of the things that they did to punish children for speaking their indigenous languages was to wash their mouth out with soap. And the soap was made with lye. And so oftentimes children got sick from lye poisoning, or sometimes they died. And when my grandmother was quite young, she witnessed the death of another child having been punished for speaking the Blackfeet language.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. We are speaking with Rosalyn LaPierre, who's a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, an indigenous writer and an environmental historian. She's also an enrolled member of the Blackfeet of Montana and Métis as well. And we are talking about President Biden's recent apology for the American government role in boarding schools that sought to erase Native American culture and separate Native American children, generations of children, from their families. There were 400 of these schools operated or funded by the U.S. government. It went from 1819 to the 1960s. I think a lot of people might be surprised to learn that. How were these schools talked about in indigenous communities?
Well, if you came from a family where members of your own family went to boarding schools, people talked about it. And people talked about, for example, how to survive in a boarding school, the kinds of things that you needed to do for self-preservation. This was not something that you could choose to go to or not go to. This was something that the United States government forced families to do. Because one of the questions I'm often asked is like, well, you know, if this was such a bad thing for your great-grandparents and your grandparents, like, why did your mom end up? And it's not something that the family has a choice of. It was something that they were forced by the United States government to send their children to boarding schools. And so because of that, again, there was oftentimes that families would share, again, stories about their experiences there, but also share how to survive in those situations.
What would somebody do to try and survive? And were children even sort of trying to preserve culture, or was it something that a lot of people just sort of gave up on under the pressure?
No, absolutely. I mean, children continued to speak their languages, and they would do it covertly. Children continued to practice their religion. They would continue to pray, for example, to their own, you know, within their own indigenous religion and religious practice. They would try to do these things covertly as much as they could. They would try not to get caught because they knew what would happen if they did get caught. They would be punished for those things. And so it's something that people continued to do in terms of practicing their own culture, practicing their own religion, speaking their own languages. But there was a lasting effect for that. There was a fear once people got home about speaking their own language, for example. And there was also, within some families, there was a fear of teaching your children languages. One of the reasons why, you know, in a lot of tribal communities, people no longer speak their native languages is not a choice that the community made, but it's something because of punishment that people endured, that families would say, I don't want my child, you know, to have to endure that punishment. So I'm going to try and have them learn how to speak English as their primary language so that when they go to school, they don't have to endure what I had to endure. And, you know, one of the things that related to religion, you know, again, oftentimes people tried to do that covertly. And then when they returned home, people oftentimes continued to practice their religion and were able to do that at home. And being able to maintain that. So there's some things that were maintained over time and other things that it was just much more difficult and people were afraid to do. I'll just share a quick story. You know, my grandmother, again, went to a Catholic boarding school, And she was often turned in by other children, because one of the things that Indian boarding schools did was they encouraged, right? They encouraged other children to turn in other children for speaking their language or for practicing their religion. And then those children got rewarded, right? And oftentimes they got rewarded with food, with extra food, because food was really used in this coercive way in a lot of boarding schools. My grandmother lived to be 97 years old, and she remembered, you know, till the day she died, the kids, every kid who turned her in for speaking her language.
Holding a grudge, understandably. We need to take a break in about a minute here. Was that sort of reluctance, that reticence, something that you encountered? Because I think we've talked in the past about how you, when you were young, you know, learned some traditions and some of the botany and other aspects of your culture. Did you find you had to draw it out of people?
Not necessarily. My grandmother and her great-grandmothers were well-known ethnobotanists, right, on the Blackfeet Reservation. And that was a tradition that they were able to carry on, even with the disruption of boarding schools, because our family, that was very much part of our family's kind of knowledge, indigenous knowledge. And so it did get passed down to me as I became an adult, and it was shared with me, and I apprenticed with my grandmother and apprenticed with an oldest aunt to learn about the ethnobotany of the Blackfeet. But it was something that was definitely disrupted in other families. Other families, again, because of people's fear that their own children were going to be punished for knowing this information or practicing this kind of indigenous knowledge, did not teach it to other generations. So it was something that families had to choose and decide when they were going to do that.
All right, we're going to take a break. We will continue with Roslyn LaPierre, an indigenous writer, environmental historian, and ethnobotanist. We are talking about President Biden's apology for Native American boarding schools, the government's role in that. We're going to continue this conversation. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about America's reckoning with Indian boarding schools, such as it is. According to the Department of the Interior, the government operated more than 400 schools across the country where Native American children were forcibly and often violently assimilated for more than a century, as recently as the 1960s. We're joined by Professor Roslyn LaPierre of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's an ethnobotanist, an environmental historian, and an indigenous writer. She's also Métis and an enrolled member of the Blackfeet of Montana. You can join us today at 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. All right, so we mentioned President Biden's apology. You said you were disappointed that he did not use the word genocide. Historians and scholars have increasingly been using that word to describe the U.S. relationship with Native Americans. Talk about that. Why is that important to you to use that, to put that name on it?
Well, I think it's important because we need to start telling the truth, right? We need to start telling the truth in the United States about what we have done in the past, not just with indigenous peoples, but with also other peoples here in the United States. And I think that the more that we can actually tell the truth about these things, then we can move towards looking towards the future and looking at how we might redress some of those things or have some sort of reconciliation.
Maybe you can make the case. You wrote a little bit about it in a piece for The Conversation recently, just sort of going over some of the scholarship that makes this argument, because, you know, genocide is one of those terms. It's obviously very politically heated now in current events relating to what's happening in Israel and in Palestine. People tend to think of it as something that's reserved for, you know, World War II, something out of the past. Make the case that scholars have made about why that applies to what the United States did.
So, yeah, so there's several historians who have taken the word genocide again, was, as you just mentioned, sort of developed out of World War II. But there was a definition, right, that the United Nations developed and created. And it is something that, again, different historians have looked at. So one person, for example, is Jeffrey Osler. He wrote a really excellent book called Surviving Genocide. And he makes the case, looking at the evidence of what happened during the 19th century with the annexation of indigenous lands, the deportation of indigenous people, the various Trail of Tears that occurred, many of which, you know, came across what is now the state of Illinois, that constituted genocide towards indigenous peoples. There's another historian named Bed Matley who has looked at what has happened in California and what has happened with you know, the California gold rush and kind of resource extraction and what happened when settlers first moved to that area, where really there were widespread massacres against indigenous people. And he described that, again, using the modern definition, that what occurred there is genocide. And then there's a legal scholar in Pennsylvania. Her name is Maggie Blackhawk, who has written about what has happened with children, both children who were part of the boarding school system, but also children who are part of the legal system where they get removed and they are either adopted out or are put in the child welfare system. That meant much of what is happening over time constitutes genocide towards indigenous communities and especially indigenous families.
You know, to this point, there have been, what, 900 deaths of Native American children at government-run boarding schools? That's according to a report from the Department of the Interior. The U.S. Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative began in 2021, shortly after more than 200 unmarked graves of children were found at a school in Canada. What do you think of what the government is doing so far beyond President Biden's recent statement to sort of reckon with this history? There was also this Road to Healing tour where survivors could share their stories, for example.
Yeah, so one of the things that when the Secretary Holland first came in as Secretary of the Interior, one of the things that she wanted to work on was to address this history of boarding schools. And so there were two reports were created and research was done. The second report came out in July of this, just this last summer. It was after that report came out that I would just say folks, Native American folks knew that there was probably going to be an apology coming at some point. Biden had mentioned earlier in his administration that he was going to do some sort of apology for boarding schools. And I think they just sort of waited until those reports were created and done, and they started that road to healing. They are still, the Department of Interior is still out recording stories of boarding school survivors, which is harder and harder to do because they are, you know, these are people who are in their 80s and in their 90s. There's actually going to be, in the next couple of weeks, right before Thanksgiving, there's going to be folks going out to Honolulu and to Hilo, Hawaii, to record the stories of Native Hawaiians and their experience in boarding schools. So it's not just sort of like Indians here on the continent. We have to kind of think broader, but also folks in Hawaii and Alaska as well.
What else would you like to see the government doing to address its past in this regard?
Well, I think, you know, there's been conversation about having some sort of process of, you know, providing funding for some of these survivors who have had to endure the experiences that they endured, and even for communities themselves to do things such as, you know, helping revitalize their indigenous languages, helping revitalize their cultural practices that were, you know, violently and forcibly taken away from them. And, you know, the United States government spends money on lots and lots of different things. And I think this is one that the United States government should put funding into and make it something that is not competitive, because one of the things we know oftentimes when the government wants to do something, they do competitive grants, right? But something that's not competitive, where tribes, if they want to revitalize their language, that they can have funding to do that, those kinds of activities.
Yeah, interesting. All right, can we talk a little bit about how Indigenous history is officially presented in America more broadly? I was in, I was in D.C. for a conference this summer. I took the opportunity to visit the National Museum of the American Indian for the first time. I wonder what you think of, you know, for example, if you've been, the way they present history there, and the way America has sort of approached this aspect of its past more broadly.
Well, I think that, you know, the vast majority of people who learn about American history, they learn about it in school. They learn about it in public school. It's not because they go to a museum or something like that. It's usually in their public school system. And different states have had different types of impact on the curriculum. As you know, in this past year, the state of Illinois has changed so that we can include Native American history in the Illinois curriculum. That is set to begin next year, 2025, 2026 is the beginning of inclusion of Native American history here in the state of Illinois. Other states have been doing it sooner than that. But I think one of the things oftentimes, again, that is missing from this larger narrative, this larger story of our relationship with Indigenous peoples is this history of violence, right? This history of violence towards Indigenous peoples. We have finally sort of come to the point when we talk about, for example, the history of slavery in the United States, that we see it for what it is, right? The violence that was inflicted towards a large group of people. I don't think we've still have seen that kind of historical narrative when we talk about Indigenous peoples. We don't talk about land. We don't talk about the stolen land. We don't talk about annexation of land. We don't talk about deportation, right? We don't talk about how Indigenous people were forcibly deported from one part of what is now the United States to another part of what is now the United States, often against their will. And again, if you look at the history of what is now the state of Illinois, crisscrossing this entire state are numerous kind of trail of tears from different tribes from the Midwest and from the South and Southeast that came across what is now Illinois. I think once we start telling the truth about this history, it's just going to be not just for Indigenous people, but for all of, you know, American society. I think it will be better for our understanding, but also for our future relationship with Indigenous peoples.
That is one of the things I learned this summer when you mentioned the trails of tears, and a big map that showed all these lines going through Illinois. I did not know about. I mean, there's a marker to the Donner Party in Springfield, in downtown Springfield, Illinois. I don't think there is one about the Trail of Tears, although I'm sure there are some markers elsewhere. But let's go to the phones. Nancy is calling from Northern Illinois on line one. Nancy, thank you for calling in. We don't have too much time, but I appreciate you making the call.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
I can. Go ahead.
I'm pretty loud. Okay, good morning. Good morning. My cousin is a full-blown Indian woman, and she lives in the state of Oklahoma. So I know all about the tribal issues because of Debbie, my cousin, last name Echo Hawk. Assuming that these deaths occurred, of course they did, naturally, of course, I am just flabbergasted and pretty much overwhelmed by hostess has said there on the air about 900 deaths. I didn't realize there were that many deaths, and I'm just so sorry about hearing this. I didn't realize it was that many, and thank you for listening.
All right, Nancy, thank you for the call. We're coming to the end of our time together, and I want to return to how we began, right? So there's this reckoning with history, and I think we've seen one of the things we can expect from the Trump administration, because he said it, is, you know, focusing American history on the great things that happened in the past is how one might say it, not necessarily doing this sort of reckoning. How are you thinking about that as we are preparing for the next 4 years?
Well, I think one of the things that we've seen, again, if we've listened to the words of former President Trump, there has been a lot of misinformation that he has shared about the history of the United States. And again, I think that we need to kind of turn towards the truth and learn about what really happened here in the United States. And again, not base our knowledge on some of the kind of mythology that he is sharing and the misinformation that he is sharing about sort of this former, quote unquote, kind of greatness. There is nothing wrong kind of with looking at the past and seeing what really happened and seeing what truly happened. It's something that I know here, you know, teaching young people, which I've done for a while now, they want to know the truth. They want to, you know, learn what really happened. They want to read about these things. And even if it's difficult, and even if it is shocking, and even if it's emotional for them, it's something that they think is important for them to know because they don't want to live in a world where all they're hearing is sort of the misinformation and the myths.
Roslyn LaPierre is a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us today on The 21st Show.
Thank you for having me again.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Coming up tomorrow, as our climate is changing around the world, so it goes here in Illinois. We'll have a preview of what's been happening, and we'll talk about Illinois Public Media's State of Change 2024 television special. This year it's focusing on invasive species that are plaguing us here in Illinois, largely as a result of climate change. That's all coming up tomorrow here on The 21st Show, which is produced by Anna Casey, Christine Hadfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Kahn. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. We appreciate hearing from you about our programs, your suggestions for future guests or stories. You can email us, talk@21stshow.org is the address, talk@21stshow.org. You can find that and every other way to contact us on our website, 21stshow.org. We've got our past programs there, and you can find links to subscribe to our podcast, or just look us up on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Yes, we're on YouTube. You can find us by searching for Illinois Public Media. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.